Okay, page 46. Sherlock Holmes said, once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. For those that don't believe in the resurrection, a miracle is what they consider to be impossible. And we've been looking at various ways in which they attack the story of the resurrection and either seek to discredit the logic, which is what we looked at on Wednesday night when we looked at the philosophy of naturalism and all the objections that it raises, or they will try to discredit the evidence. That's what we're going to consider today, various ways to explain away the resurrection story as nothing but a myth. The last thing that we want to do, Lord willing, on Wednesday night is look at other ways to explain the resurrection and the evidence that we have for it that are at least as plausible, if not more so, than the resurrection story as it is told to us in the four Gospels. What we're going to see, I think, just as we did on Wednesday night, is that the objections that people raise or the alternative theories or the things that they bring up to try to discredit the story as a whole, without even considering the evidence, those things are what is impossible. And if they cannot adequately explain the evidence that we have, then we are left with something that, yes, it is highly improbable for a body to come back to life. But it is the most sensible way to explain the data that we have in favor of the resurrection. It'll be a few minutes before we look into any particular text in the Bible, but if you want to, you can go ahead and open up to Acts 17. And when we do get into a little bit of the Word this morning, we'll start there. We're going to consider three things that people submit to believers today, and still have done for a while, still do even today, to try to discredit the evidence. And the first one is this. When you talk about Jesus being the Son of God, going to the cross, dying, and then coming back from the grave, and you obviously make the case that this is a real person that you ought to have real faith in. One of the things that people will say to get around that is, how do we even know that he even existed in the first place? Who is to say that he was real? I wasn't there back then. You weren't there back then. How do we know that there is anything to this Jesus guy in the first place? I remember being in high school in one of my classes, and somehow or another this topic came up, and when it did, it was a Baptist girl of all people in the room that said this. She said, well, how do we even know that he existed to begin with? I'm fairly certain that in Deep East Texas circa year 2000 that no Baptist preacher was getting up in a pulpit saying, we don't even know if he was alive in the first place. But I don't know what kind of reasons would have been given if she'd asked the question by her pastor or her parents as to how you can know that he lived. I do know that reasons like you just believe it, you just feel it in your heart, those aren't going to stand up to scrutiny. And we can and should do much better than that. It's not unlikely that you will hear this, especially in today's world where the climate is becoming more and more secular. And so this is something that, while we have refused to entertain it, in terms of having to proactively make the case that Jesus did in fact live, it is something that we need to know how to respond to. It's not unlikely that you will hear this objection raised by people. So on the second page, page 47, I had you list the five stubborn facts. If Jesus never lived, which of the five would this theory that he never lived, this statement that he never existed, which of the five would it explain, if any? The empty tomb. If he never lived, then he never died. There's no body to bury. There's no body to disappear on the third day from within the tomb. But that's only one of the five. And the first four, these are very, very difficult for this idea that he never lived to get around. First of all, what is our first fact in the series of five? He died by crucifixion. How do we prove that? How do we know that?
Because
Let me start off by asking you this question first. Have you ever heard someone say, you can't use the Bible to prove the Bible? That's a bit like telling the accused that you cannot take the stand in your own defense in court. If we are challenging the Bible, and if someone has indicted the Bible as being untrustworthy, by standards of fairness, we ought to allow it to speak in its own defense. Now, we've done that some already as we've gone through the study. One of the things that we did, we listened to what it had to say about rulers, about places, about political systems, about locations back then, and we tested all that. And what did our test show? Did it show that it was trustworthy or not trustworthy?
Trustworthy.
Trustworthy. So, if I know nothing else, even if I have a hard time wrapping my head around the idea of a virgin birth or a resurrection from the dead, can I at least take it to the bank when it tells me that so-and-so lived in this time at this place? Sure, there's no reason that we've discovered not to believe the Bible when it tells us about simply natural things, natural occurrences. So if it tells me that a man named Jesus lived, even if I don't know that he did cast out demons and the like, can I at least have confidence that he lived? I ought to. But is that the only way that we can know that there was a man named Jesus? When we talked about the first fact in the five, that he died by crucifixion, who else did we appeal to establish that?
The historians that lived at that time.
And these were people that were believers and they went to church every Sunday, right?
No.
Oh, they weren't. What kind of people were they? If they had a religion, what religion were they?
Josephus was a Jew.
Does Josephus have any interest at all in proving what this Jew named Matthew has to say? Not at all. And yet he validates it. He says that there was a man named Jesus, and he was put to death on the cross by a man named Pilate, who was procurator of Judea. Other people that said that Jesus died by crucifixion would include Tacitus. He was a Roman, so if he had any religion at all, what religion was he?
Pagan.
He's not a guy that would say there's only one God, or that if there is this one God you tell me so much about, then Jesus is definitely not his son. He's not anybody that would make that kind of a claim, and yet he says that Jesus died by crucifixion. And we looked at actually five sources. We looked at Tacitus, we looked at a man named Lucian, Maribar Serapion, Josephus, and even the Jewish Talmud, which is a commentary on the Old Law that was written in the first and second centuries. Even the most bitter foes of Jesus never denied that he lived. So if they can say, very close in time to the events and the lifetime of people who witnessed those events, that there was a man named Jesus, who are we today to question that? And that's the thing. If somebody does question whether or not Jesus even lived in the first place, they have no basis upon which to make that claim. But that doesn't stop famous people from making the claim. I talked about a girl in high school. Anybody heard the name Bertrand Russell? That ring a bell? Some of you have heard it. He was a very famous atheist. And he wrote an essay called Why I Am Not a Christian. And he made the claim, we can't even be certain that he was real to begin with. And it's astounding that people would say that because it just flies in the face of all the evidence that we have. So whenever you hear somebody say this, one of the things we need to ask is, how do you know that? They might say, well, how do you know that he did live? You weren't alive back then. No, I wasn't. But I know some people that were. Who do you know? And what do they say? I want to know. What's your evidence if you have it? So obviously we know that Jesus was a man of history. And even if somebody were to make the claim, again, we appeal to our five stubborn facts. Somebody has to deal with the evidence. You can't just dismiss it simply because you find it inconvenient or you don't want to deal with it. You must deal with the evidence.
Todd?
Yes?
A quick response, deal with everything you said, might just be, did Julius Caesar live?
Right.
Say, yeah. How do you know?
Right.
And they'll answer your question for you.
Right. That's it. Same principle applies to any person from antiquity. Ask them, did Abraham Lincoln live? Yes. How do you know? There's thousands, millions of people that you could appeal to on that same basis. Good point. Okay, the second one, at the bottom of page 47. This one, I think, depending on who's packaging it and who's selling it, is the most convincing and the most dangerous objection that someone can be faced with that is a believer, especially if they are not already equipped with how to answer it. I mentioned on the sheet there was a movie that came out about 10 years ago called Zeitgeist. And you can watch it for free on YouTube. It's divided up into three sections, and it deals with conspiracy theories that he suggests to explain how people in power keep the masses under control. And one of the ways in which he says that they keep people under control is through religion. Now, if you're a Bible student, you have to agree with at least some of that claim. When the kingdom split in the Old Testament, and when Jeroboam in the north set forth the two golden calves and says, "These are the gods who brought you up from the land of Egypt," he did that to protect his power, his hold over the people. He did not want them to go back to the house of David in the south. So he created a religious system that satisfied them conveniently in terms of helping them fulfill what they felt obligated to do religiously. And it is true that people in power will create a religion to maintain their power structure. The question is whether or not that happened in the case of Christianity. And one of the things that they say in the movie is, of course, that there were, before Jesus and the gospel was written, there were tons and tons and tons of gods that died and rose again all throughout pagan mythology in all corners of the world, whether it's Greece, ancient Babylon, Egypt, wherever. And when you get to 2,000 years ago and these guys are cooking up the gospel story, it's just the same old tale with a new face and a new name. And in a lot of ways, it seems extremely convincing at first. Of course, that depends on them not having to actually be honest and break down where they get their information for all these supposed parallels they find between the gospel and these other stories. But just think for a minute about how this could be convincing to someone. I want to tell you briefly a story, just the key highlights of it, and then I want you to tell me what story I'm telling you. Okay? So, a father sends his son to earth. This son is raised by a poor couple. The first initial of the father's name is J. First initial of the mother's name is M. As the lifetime of this child unfolds, we catch a glimpse of him when he's an infant. A short while later, when he's an adolescent, and then when we meet him again, he's 30 years old and he's ready to take on his public ministry. Whose story is that? Who says Jesus? Show of hands. Everybody that says Jesus, congratulations, you got it wrong. Superman. 1978, Superman the movie. Screenwriter said he modeled the story on the way the Gospels present Jesus. When I was a kid in fourth grade, we had a reading time, and there were all these books on the shelf, and I was trying to figure out which one to read. And, you know, a kid always judges the book by the cover or the title, which one's going to grab my attention. And there was this really neat one that said, "The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe." Now, I had no idea what a wardrobe was, but a lion and a witch, I knew what those were. They sounded cool, so I'm going to read that one. And in that one, the lion dies, comes back from the dead. I was 4 years old, or not 4 years old, but I was in fourth grade. I don't know that I caught all those subtleties. Around that same time in the comic book, Superman was killed, and then he was resurrected. I never stopped to think, you know what? They borrowed that from somebody else. But of course, as I got older, and I began to see why they modeled certain aspects of his character on other things that people knew about, yeah, you could tell they were borrowing this from the Gospels and what they say about Jesus. So that begs the question. If other people can borrow from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, can't they borrow from other people? That's what skeptics say. So let's talk about this a little bit. Look on page 48. First of all, if you watch this movie that I mentioned, or not you, maybe it's your grandchild or your kid. when they are in high school or they go to college. They get around people that raise these kind of questions, and they tell them, just check the movie out. One of the things that the guy says in the movie is, first of all, everybody knows that Jesus' birthday is December 25th, and this is a pagan festival date that has been around for a long time, and the Christians just borrowed it, they appropriated it, and slapped the Christian brand on it, and now, lo and behold, you've got this great festival that celebrates Jesus' birth, and it's nothing new. What is the problem with making that critique of the Gospels? Yeah. Of the two that tell us about his birth, Matthew and Luke, do either of them say when he was born?
No.
They don't. If anything, it was not in wintertime because the shepherds were out tending their flocks. The Gospels do not say this. Some people do say it. The evolution of Catholicism, of course, borrowed many pagan elements, including their feast days and festivals. They say that he was born on December the 25th. If anything, it's a critique of man's own corruption of the gospel story and not the gospel story itself. Below this, though, we have a list of five gods. These are the ones that skeptics really like to offer up as evidence that Jesus is just the latest iteration of a story that's been around a long time. If you had a chance to look up some of these, you may have found some interesting details about their supposed deaths. And, well, even if their death is confirmed within the mythology, their resurrection is another matter altogether. We'll talk about them, though. We'll save the first one, Osiris. We'll save him for last, because this is the only one, probably, that has a death and a life after death that includes a body that precedes the gospel story. So we'll save him for a few minutes. The second one, Tammuz. I have no idea how to pronounce that, but that's as close as I'm going to bother to try. Anyone find out anything interesting about this god's death and rebirth, such as it was? My first question would be, if in any of these you look them up, would you find a crucifixion account?
No.
You will not. Would you find a clear-cut death, a burial, then the body and the soul reuniting, and then a person being seen among many witnesses over a period of many days? You're not going to find that either. Tammuz went down to the underworld and took the place of his lover, who was already in the realm of the dead. That's about it. There is no detail of the story that suggests a return from the underworld or a bodily resurrection, simply a trip down to the realm of the dead where he stays. The third one, Adonis, is a Greek god. Now, we do know from the stories that he died. Did he die by crucifixion? Did he die because he willingly laid down his life to sacrifice it for the well-being of others? This man, this god rather, was gored to death by a bull. Attis, number four, committed suicide. That is an ignoble end in comparison with Jesus' death, the way it is portrayed in the Gospels as a selfless sacrifice for the benefit of mankind. He commits suicide in a moment of madness, in a horrific way that I'm not going to say in public. And then Marduk, the last one. This one was interesting because this is one of the gods that skeptics appeal to. And yet I cannot find in any of my research a clear reference to not just a resurrection, but not even death. And you know, even if I don't believe the resurrection story that the Gospels tell me, I can at least be certain of Jesus' death by crucifixion. I can't even be certain of that in the case of this god. Let's go back up to Osiris then, the first one. As I said, this is the only one. He's an ancient Egyptian god, so he's been around a long time. This is the only story of a death and so-called resurrection that predates Jesus. As to how he died and what happens to his body, It depends on who's telling the story, which, by the way, is another interesting thing about these gods. Their stories are not consistent, but in the case of what we have in the Gospels with Jesus, the story is consistent. One story says he was killed by drowning in the Nile, and his brother recovered his body and then cut it up into 14 pieces. These pieces were scattered across the land, and I think that it was his wife. She collected all the body parts and put them back together, but she was missing one. So you have a man of 13 pieces now instead of 14. And once his body is reassembled, he is given a status as a god of the underworld. And all of this would suggest that, unlike the resurrection of Jesus, where the body is dead and then it comes back to life, and then it ascends back into heaven to be the Prince of Life, once this god is killed, he stays dead, and then when his body is reassembled, he gets this role that's handed to him as being in the underworld, where he's still basically a dead god. So as one man pointed out, in the case of Osiris, this is not a resurrection, it's a zombification. He is an undead god, as it were, not a god that was dead and became alive once more. So if you look on the bottom of page 48, when you look at these stories of gods that died, supposedly came back, even if that's true, and there's so many others that we could appeal to, here's one that I know a lot of people know about today, Thor, son of Odin, supposedly died and came back from the dead. There's many, many others that you could bring up. But when you look at those accounts, you have to always ask yourself, am I really seeing something that would be the foundation upon which the Gospels could base their own story? It's not a stretch to see clear parallels between Superman and Jesus. It's not a stretch to see clear parallels between the Gospels and C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia books. That's not a stretch. This is a stretch. It's a big stretch. And we'll see why in Acts 17. If you haven't opened up to Acts 17 yet, go ahead. And we can turn over to page 49. At best, these are just vague similarities. If that. One of the things you have to ask is, as I said before, how many of them were crucified? How many of them died willingly? How many of them were seen after their death and resurrection? On the next page, at the top, the question I asked was, how old is the earliest account of Adonis' resurrection? You may not have been able to find this or didn't have time to look it up. The earliest account that we have of his resurrection, this is interesting, 150 A.D. 150 A.D. What might that tell you? The claim is that the gospel writers ripped off and recycled what the pagans said. But in 150 A.D., the pagans are now talking about a god that died and rose again. So the question is, who stole from whom? Did the gospel writers take what the pagans said, or did the pagans start to think, maybe I could take some of these details from what the gospels say and what the Christians believe and work that into what we believe about our gods? I want you to go back to what we talked about when we dated these documents. When we looked at some of the manuscripts that we have, if you were able to look back to pages 12 through 14, if you got those with you, or if you looked at them before class this morning, we talked about some of the oldest manuscripts that we have. The oldest existing manuscript that contains all four Gospels and the Book of Acts, guess what year it dates back to? This is the Chester Beatty Papyri. 150. Now those are the copies. So if the copies are showing up in 150, what does that say about the originals? They're showing up even earlier than that. The oldest legend that we have of Adonis coming back from the dead is, in fact, that same year. We have a fragment of John's manuscript. The John Rylands manuscript contains a few verses in John 18, shows up in 130 A.D., even earlier than the Adonis myth. If I was just to read the four Gospels, and look at the evidence within the books themselves, and I wanted to date them. What's the outside latest I could say they were written in the first century? What year would they have to, would they have had to have been written before?
70 AD.
That's right. Now, if I wanted to look at just Luke and Acts, this is why we talked about all these dates, right? I said they might come in handy down the road. If I wanted to date Luke and Acts, I would say that they were written at the latest what year? It's even earlier than 70 AD. 63 AD. Now, Keith, we get to 1 Corinthians 15. In 1 Corinthians 15, you have the kernel of the gospel and you have that long list of appearances of Jesus. When was that written?
57
AD. So you're telling me that this Adonis story shows up 100 years after the earliest written account of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus? Come on. Who ripped off who? It's not the Gospels taken from the pagans. It's the other way around. Speaking of the pagans, look in Acts 17. Starting with me in verses 17 and 18. One of the questions I have on the sheet, how certain can we be that these earlier pagan tales contain stories of bodily resurrection? Well, the answer is pretty obvious. You can't be certain of that at all. A lot of pagans simply did not believe in that. In Acts 17 and verse 17, you read about Paul. Verse 16, you see that he's in Athens. Verse 17, he goes to the synagogue. And then in verse 18, some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Some were saying, what would this idle babbler wish to say? Others, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities. By strange, we would take that to mean unfamiliar. I've never heard this before. What about it is so unfamiliar to these pagans? It's so striking that they find it to be odd and foreign and alien to them. Because he was preaching Jesus and the what?
Resurrection.
They had no concept of a bodily resurrection from the dead. Look down further. When you get to verse 31, Paul warns these people about the judgment day. He says that God has furnished proof to all men at the end of the verse by raising him from the dead. So here we are again. The bodily resurrection of Jesus. In verse 32, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer. Well, why would they sneer? Here are guys that, when you look back earlier in the text, in verse 21, all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new. And a lot of times that's what we want our Bible classes and our sermons to be, right? So we don't have to mentally check out. I've heard all this before, right? That's just human tendency. Okay, we want everything to be new all the time. But we say that, but a lot of times that's not really what people want. What they want is what they've always believed and what they've always thought to be true, just repackaged in a new way that lets them get engaged or re-engaged with it all over. And in verse 32, that's pretty clear. We want something new from you, but don't make it so weird that I can't buy into it. I can't buy into this because we don't believe in a bodily resurrection from the dead. To the Greeks, when they died, they went to the realm of the dead and they were disembodied spirits. It was a very bad afterlife. They thought that life on the earth was better than to die and go into the afterlife. Some of them didn't even think you had a full form. It might have just been your face when you went there. So for Paul to come along and say, there is a Son of God that died and rose again in Judea, and I'm here to tell you about him. And by the way, his resurrection means that we will all likewise be raised from the dead. Get out of here, Paul. This is too much for us. Look over in Matthew 28. So you have Osiris, the Egyptian god. His body's cut up into 14 pieces, and then it's reassembled. Minus one. He is not whole. But in Matthew 28, and in verse 9, Jesus met them, the women, and greeted them. They came up and took hold of his feet. If I know nothing else, at least his feet got out of the tomb, right? But you drop down in verse 13, and listen to what the Jews say. You are to say his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. Well, how much of him got out of there? Whole thing. When John and Peter go to the tomb and they look inside, they find the burial clothes folded up nice and neat, set aside. He doesn't need them anymore because the whole corpse, no longer a corpse, got out of the tomb. In Luke 24, verse 36, this is Jesus' first appearance to the 11, minus Thomas. He shows up and says, "Peace be to you." Verse 37, he almost gives them a heart attack. They were startled and frightened and thought they were seeing a spirit. He said, "Why are you troubled? Why do doubts arise in your heart? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a spirit does not have what?
Flesh and bones.
That's the way that the Greeks thought of the afterlife and what happened to you after you died. You didn't have flesh and bones. You may not have even had much of a spirit either. Like I said, and they're thinking it was just a face to some of them. He said, "A spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." You keep reading, you find out he's got more than just his exterior though. In verse 41, he raises a question. "Have you anything here to eat?" They gave him a piece of a broiled fish. He took it and ate it before them. That would seem to indicate that it's not just his body. He's got all of his organs, his digestive system, everything. It's all there. It's all in good working order. And you have his statement to Thomas in John 20. "You don't believe me? Look and touch. Put your hand on my side if you're still unbelieving." Look at 1 John chapter 1. First John chapter 1 and verse 1. If I understand John right, what he's talking about here is the risen Jesus. It's not just the fact that he came to earth in the form of man and fulfilled a 3-year ministry as God in the flesh. It's that they saw, they heard, they touched that which they initially refused to believe in, that he was a bodily risen Savior. What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. As you read further in the text, all the way through the book, you'll see that, for example, chapter 4 and verse 2, John was combating a heresy at the time that denied Jesus had come in the flesh. And chapter 4 and verse 2, "By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus has come in the flesh is from God. Those that said otherwise he called Antichrist." A bodily existence, an incarnation, a bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead. You do not find that in pagan mythology. So that leads us to the last question that I have on this particular objection. What evidence is there to conclude that any of these gods actually existed in history apart from being figures within myths and fables? None whatsoever. If I were a skeptic, and if I were at least trying to be honest about my doubts, I might say that there was no resurrection, but could I honestly say and expect my claim to hold up under scrutiny that there never was a man named Jesus of Nazareth? I could not say that. I might could say, our third objection here, yeah, there was a man named Jesus, and they just stacked all these myths on top of him as the years went by. They said he did all these things that he never did, but yeah, he existed. I could never say that about Adonis, Osiris, or any other of these gods for which people base this claim that the Gospels just stole from them. All right, so the last thing we have on the sheet. The legend grew over time. So this one's a little more honest in that it at least admits that Jesus lived and that he died on the cross, or maybe he just, you know, he had to die because he lived 2,000 years ago. He's not still around. But he lived and he died, but feeding the 5,000, he never did that. Calling Lazarus forth from the dead, didn't happen. His followers, or maybe the next couple of generations after them. They started to create all these fables and these legends about him, and eventually his reputation grew so big that, wouldn't you know it, today people actually worship him as the Son of God. But he never claimed to be that. People that knew him never claimed him to be that. It's just the story that grew in the telling. Is there any rational basis upon which to make that claim? Can you honestly say that the gospel was first told, or people first found out about Jesus, but then maybe decades, maybe centuries later, then people started saying that he died and came back from the dead?
No.
You cannot. We talked about this. You may have been wondering, why is this so important? Why do I need to know, for example, that, for example, in Galatians chapter 1, that within 3 years, Galatians 1:18, Paul talks about what he did after his conversion. 3 years later, I went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas and stayed with him 15 days. Here's a man that said that Jesus appeared to the other apostles. He was in a position very early on in his Christian walk to know what these men believed, maybe 33, maybe 36 A.D., why is it important for me to know that I have outside testimony, even from those 12 original men, that says, yes, they did believe that Jesus died and rose again from the dead because of what people say? That's why. That's why I need to know.
Well, you don't even have to go that far.
You don't.
You can go to Acts 2.
You can.
It was just a few weeks after all this happened.
You can.
And Peter talked about it in his first gospel sermon.
Yes. I was going to suggest that one just next. We talked about this even a few weeks ago. When Luke is recording Peter's sermon, that's 33 A.D., and in that very sermon, at least twice he says, not only has Jesus been raised, but we saw him. That goes on sermon after sermon after sermon in the book of Acts. It goes on all the way through the New Testament, the idea that Jesus died and rose again, and we know that these books were written within a few decades of the events that we have in our four Gospels. So, nobody can honestly say all of this was invented decades, centuries after the fact, and it just morphed into something that it never was intended to be. They can't honestly say it, but you know what? They say it. They might say it in high schools. They might say it in colleges. Think about how to respond to these kind of objections. It may not be a stumbling block to your faith at all, but how many of us are going to go back through college or high school? What about all the kids in the rooms next to us? You need to know something about these objections and how to respond. Yes?
As you're saying, talking about this and the fact that we may not be facing this again, but teaching it or knowing it ourselves as we deal with it later on in our life, we need to understand that the world is devolving into more and more ignorance. I think that the biggest way you can see that is this whole idea of the flat earth. You get celebrities, athletes, this idea that, oh, the world's flat. There's no proof. It's a big conspiracy. So the best way you can combat things like that, combat things like this, which is a lot more important, is equip yourself, arm yourself for conversations like this, because the world is becoming more and more ignorant, more and more dumb. And that's what's prevalent in today's society. We're going to get away from what is provable. We're going to get away from logical thought. We're going to get into what I believe because I want to believe it, because I want to be right, because I'm selfish. So, we should never, I've made this comment before, but we should never be afraid to test our faith and to study deeper to understand what the truth is, because you'll only reaffirm and strengthen it.
I agree. And it's not like, it's not like in a typical sermon or a Bible class, any of us are going to be wrestling with questions of whether or not the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus was part of the message from the beginning. But other people are, and it's going to be because they simply heard it from someone else, and that other person they heard it from might seem like they have an air of credibility. They got a PhD after their name, or they made this really slick video on YouTube that's been seen by millions of people. There's got to be something to what they say, and we better be prepared for that. All right, so the last page, page 50. The major takeaway is that Jesus was a man of history. He really lived, he really died. I believe he really lived again. And you can establish that from the facts that we have at our disposal. The gospel writers and preachers did not recycle pagan myth. You just think about it. They're trying to build a movement that attracts not just Jews, but Gentiles. They're not going to invent something that attempts to appeal to people on the basis of what they already believe, when in fact they don't believe in that. These myths recycled gospel truth. And there can be no doubt that, as John said in 1 John 1 and verse 1, what was from the beginning, what was from the beginning of their preaching, of their message, what the disciples saw with their eyes, heard with their ears, and touched with their hands concerning the risen Jesus, that was what was proclaimed through all the world. All right. So any final questions or comments before we dismiss?
Would it be a parallel? I just sit here thinking. Say after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, you know, after people died, they really became great people. And somebody could say, you know, all this story about him having this sharp dress that was so stunning and impressed people, that was all built up after he died just to exalt him. And so all you would have to do is what you've done with the documents of the Testament is establish a document that established the Gettysburg Address was written and spoken time that it attributed to.
Right.
Use that theory.
Right. Right. Wally?
Observation. You alluded to the point earlier that in terms of some of these gods, biblical gods, it's hard even to find a story that stands still. There's all kinds of stories. That's the nature of myths that grow over time. You look at the gospel did not grow over time. It was established. And in fact, Paul made the point in Galatians that anybody that changes it is to be accursed. And so it was placed in time as a historical description of what happened. And there are people, even in that time, that tried to start myths about Christ. And they were successful for some period of time. The Jews did, his enemies did. The disciples came back and robbed the tomb. And so myths are just things that people love to talk about. But that's not the nature of the gospel. It was set because it was true. And there was no attempt on the part of the gospel writers to extend and to elaborate on it like we tend to do on myths.
Right.
Kind of like the old game of telephone.
Right.
That's what happens in myth grows. You don't see that in the gospel.
Or that fish you caught that you're so proud of. Yeah. When you look at just even the manuscripts that we have, we talked about this, do they show faithful transmission of the story or corruption and embellishment over time? You don't find it. Rocky?
I'm reminded what Christ told his disciples when he was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24:24. He said that many false Christs and false prophets will arise trying to mislead you. So, you know, all these myths and stuff like that and all these stories, you know, we as Christians are going to be forewarned and they're going to be out there, but don't be misled by it.
Right. Very good. Okay, the next lesson is available in the foyer for Wednesday night.